So welcome everybody. I hope that everybody had a lovely and productive break. We are starting the Lenterm at the Los Pa Center with Dr. Glider Hernandez. He did his EPhil at Oxford back in the day and after a stint at the ICJ where he worked for Judges Sima and Tomka. He joined Durham University where he is now an associate professor. Dr. Hernandez has published very widely, and I think that of particular note is his very intellectually interesting and refreshing a monograph on the ICJ and the judicial function. Today, Dr. Hernandez is here to talk to us about systemic agents in international law, which will certainly provide a very good opportunity for us to reflect a little bit on the discipline and its people. So thank you very much for joining us, Dr. Hernandez, and please, you have the floor.
Thank you, everyone, and I'll hunch over this lectern, which is not quite full size for me, but I'm used to that by now. And my goal is to not occupy the entire time with the sound of my own voice and hopefully get some interesting reflections, especially at the end, where my research is a little bit more in the progress stage. And I'd really welcome some input from this fantastic community. Thank you to Karen for arranging everything so brilliantly. I don't think she's here, but you all know who she is, and she took very good care of organizing. And of course, to Sarah for the kind invitation. It's always an honor and a privilege to come to the other place. Right. So today's lecture, I'd like to talk about the idea of systematicity, which is at the heart of a research project that I'm working on called Constructing Authority in International Law. I'm exploring in that ways in which the legal form, legal argumentation, and legal actors interoperate to construct, maintain, and safeguard the coherence and relevance of international law. I believe that this project has both descriptive but also normative functions, and that it calls attention to some of the injustices that we are complicit in creating. But at the same time, it's not purely a critical project. In fact, it's not particularly a critical project in that it seeks out to map out these structures as a starting point for further research. And what I'll be presenting on today, I'll be starting with the concept of systematicity, which I believe is a long-held article of faith in our discipline. So I'll start with that, basically. One of the claims that many international lawyers adhere to is that international law exists and operates as a fully-fledged legal system, if not identical to, at least on par with municipal legal systems. This Enlightenment ideal of legal system, the structure of which then we can observe in scientific, objective and detached manners, is a sort of totem, an aspiration for we international lawyers who seek to affirm the relevance of international law on the global plane. In many respects, it's an article of faith, asserted as logically necessary, but often very much just in passing before moving to one substantive argument. I'll present to you a few quotes in that regard that kind of just set the stage for what I'm talking about. Page 1 of Rosalind Higgins' Problems and Process starts with, international law is not rules. It is a normative system, a system that secures a desirable degree of social order. That systematicity is regarded as axiomatic, and in many respects, it's presented in a way that it makes it hard for us to think about international law that doesn't invoke some idea of structure or system. We see that also. Now, I'm writing a textbook right now, so I've been deeply immersed in that, and that can sometimes be quite dull, as you can imagine. But there are other sources in which we can see that this way of thinking permeates the very zenith of the discipline. And one of those sources I enjoyed looking through were the Hague Academy lectures. Now, in many respects, those are the zenith of an international law professional's career. And you see throughout these grand general courses, very significant ones that focus and start with the grand unity and systematicity of the international legal system. I'll point out three examples which come from different legal traditions to kind of illustrate the point. The first one that I'll start with is Georges Abissal in the 1980s. And forgive me, but I have the quote in the original French, and I'll read it. I'll read just this one out. I have heard that we're not supposed to do that every time here, but his conception of systematicity was functionalist, and as he put it forward, dès qu'il existe une différenciation de fonction ou de catégorie de normes internationales, cela implique nécessairement qu'elles sont reliées ou articulées d'une certaine manière les unes par rapport aux autres, qu'il existe une structure ou une architecture qui sous-tend et qui se dégage de cette articulation particulière des normes. So essentially, once there exists a differentiation of functions or of categories of legal norms, there must exist necessarily a link or articulation that joins the two, and that there is a structure or an architecture that underlies these, and that dégage, that's really difficult, but that exposes this particular articulation of norms. In the 1990s, Carl Zemanek drew a distinction between international legal system as a concept and international legal order, which is perhaps a bit broader, with the former referring to a more narrow body of legal rules structured as such, and the concept of legal order being broader, but nevertheless, in application of the maxim ubi societas, ubi jus, that it connotes legal subjects, the existence of legal subjects, and certain basic, although perhaps decentralized functions. But the point remained across whether you think about it as a system or an order. International law is organized into a structure that possesses systemic qualities, at least in methodological or analytical terms. And finally, in this present decade, your very own Judge James Crawford rejected the categorization of international law as merely a miscellany of primary rules, and contended quite strongly that international law systematicity, and this is the point that I'll start with for my argument, is established as a function of a social process between states and other persons, that it is a key aspect of the structuring of human relations beyond the state, and that international law, to his mind, is a fully autonomous legal system with a recognizable form, a form that is based in common fundamental ideas, responsibility, sources, treaties, interpretation, and responsibility. Now, that last one he would pick, wouldn't he? Maybe I'm beating a dead horse. I realize this. And perhaps, you know, even people like Joseph Raz have suggested that concerning oneself with the systematicity of a legal system is unnecessary. I mean, as he puts it, the term legal system is not even a technical term. It's just a way of informing thinking about how law works, of conceiving of an intricate web of interconnected laws, a sufficient volume of conventional and customary law, and moderated by common rules of interpretation. One sees this also in the thinking of Marty Koskinen, who says, "It is often said that law is a system. By this, no more need be meant than the various rules, decisions, and principles of which the law consists do not appear randomly related to one another." I disagree. I argue that once one ventures beyond the proposition, the basic proposition that a legal order such as international law existed through interconnection, I think that important questions arise, especially for those of us who are engaged with the discipline. I think the questions that are relevant are, what is the magic stuff that makes it a system? What makes it properly legal? Or if not properly legal, what kind of system is it? And are there wider implications for asserting the systematic nature of international law? And are those implications political, strategic, or otherwise ideological? It is in response to these wider questions that we do have vibrant debates in international law, and where certain contestable notions have been advanced to essentially provide that magic stuff, that glue that constitutes a system, with theories of normative hierarchy and global constitutionalism, a more or less complete set of primary and secondary rules, or the more controversial, globally shared or communitarian values and interests to justify international law's systematic qualities. Again, though, I've always felt in scholarship that these are in line more with assertion rather than careful justification. So in this lecture, I propose to move beyond modelling international law as a system as such, and study the recursive relationship between the body of rules and principles that in some respects constitute a system, but study their relationship both with sources, doctrine, and theory, and debates over how these in turn construct and constitute certain officials, certain individuals, who also form part of that system. I don't think it's sufficient to argue that international law is a system of rules, but it is a system of rules and principles that is undergirded by a group of individuals, people like us to a degree, who safeguard its coherence, project it into areas of future relevance, etc. I believe international law in this respect is a social system, and it's a social system where legal sources are instrumentalized and used tactically by those social agents in order to maintain and perpetuate the system. In this respect, and this is the part where I'm currently researching and would really welcome feedback, I will explore the necessary role of these individuals and the role of officials. Now, I've tried to be bold and strike out with a new term, and I call them systemic agents. And it's a deliberate departure from Herbert Hart's idea of legal officials, which he used to describe judges and other officials who embody and internalize the rules of a legal system. And this is deliberate. I exclude the word legal because I think it connotes thoughts as to due authorization, how an official is authorized, for what purposes and why, and of course the legal form. Now these underlie the present discussion, but they form part of its substrate rather than my principal argument. As for agency over officialdom, again, the question of authorization emerges because the category of agency is not one necessarily that, that connotes legitimacy, but also is about members of the international bar or activists who engage with law instrumentally, who in turn do affect the system without having to assert some sort of formal claim to be acting, for example, as a legal advisor to a state or a legal advisor speaking on behalf of an institution or an international judge. I will consider these later, but my point is simply that no legal or in fact social system can exist without the presence of these individual agents who act on its behalf. Again, whether it's to safeguard its coherence and integrity, whether it's to refashion it in line with social evolutions, or to propel it forward, I believe that they're connected by a unifying inner logic which transcends, in international law, merely interstate relations and constitutes a functioning recursive relationship between officials, states, and the constituencies that are subject and the object of international law. Now, depending on your point of view, what I'm arguing is either positive or deeply troubling. For the purpose of this lecture, please take my identification of systemic agents as a category as an exercise in sociological description rather than a normative claim. And it's a call for a re-examination as to how we as scholars engage with international law. So, to return to the idea of international law as a system, it wasn't always so. This notion emerged in the 19th century, around the time that Enlightenment principles and the doctrines of positivism began to permeate the way that we engage with international law in the 19th century, which was a period where we moved away from naturalist thinking and embraced those new methods derived from science, an epistemology centered on observation, on induction, and a distinct new emphasis on utilitarian logic. And I think it was at this point that international law began to be construed as a socially constructed object. Now, one of the most influential traditions that contributed to international law systematic character was that of Germany. Now, Stefan Wogenauer has challenged how we sometimes play the stereotypes in this regard, that there is in the English-speaking world a view of German scholarship is focused on rationality, systematic coherence, logical consistency, building on first principles, an obsession with taxonomy, abstractness, and precision. But I do think that, that 19th and 20th century debates by German-trained legal scholars were both striking and hugely influential in propounding the idea that international law had systematic qualities, from Martens, Hefter, and Lunskili, and extending also to German-speaking emigres, such as Lieber, Oppenheim, Schwarzenberger, and Kelsen in the 20th century, an emphasis has remained on a coherent series system of laws, one that can rationally resolve potential conflicts and outcomes, and through which the system maintains and protects itself. Within Europe, at least, that systemic ideal from the Germanic tradition has persisted, though obviously other major European traditions, and we'll speak just of the British and the French, have diverged in respect of other foundational questions. They've not necessarily called into question the conception of international law as a system. In this particular case, and I'm most familiar with the British system, one could venture that it is the influence of German-trained international lawyers throughout the middle of the 20th century, one of which has given this centre the name that it bears. But for all this, it is not something that has always been universal. It is not something that has always been part of international law. It has not always been regarded as an autonomous system. It used to be linked systematically with other systems. And I think we also can see that in the 20th century there have been new challenges. The American critique of European formalism embodied perhaps most prominently in the New Haven School, or what Jean d'Apremont has witheringly termed the culture of non-order called pluralism, which makes no claim on the systematization of international law. Conceiving of international law as a system and the historical excursion that I've given is not relevant merely to recount an intellectual historiography of the discipline. I claim that in constructing international law as a self-standing closed legal order, systematization represented a strategic positioning of international law. It was a project to save international law from politics and to affirm the presence and relevance of law in international relations. Perhaps for this reason, international lawyers continue to do it independently from social and political contexts today. And to give one almost easy example, Article 15 of the Statute of the International Law Commission refers that institution expressly to the systematization of rules of international law, which in practice, as we all understand, has been understood as a task of classification and codification within a unified frame. And this is a task that most prominently the ILC took seriously with gusto when it intervened in the fragmentation debates in the early 21st century. Now, I'll just take you through a couple of choice quotes in there because I think they're illustrative of mainstream thinking about international law and the assumptions that we carry with us, whether in our teaching or in our practice. So the ILC, in framing its report, explained that the task of legal reasoning is a quintessentially purposive activity. It is, and it aims to establish the systematic relationship between the various decisions, rules and principles, and how that relationship should be conceived. Specifically, and this is perhaps something that we don't think about very much when we discuss theories of interpretation, the ILC said that interpretation builds systemic relationships between rules and principles by envisaging them as part of some human effort or purpose, and that systematic thinking penetrates all legal reasoning, including the practice of law application by judges and administrators. Now, and I think this is straight from Koskinen, but the Commission indicated that a certain pragmatism is necessary. It said, in conditions of social complexity, it is pointless to insist on formal unity. But from the outset, you see from the ILC an enduring faith in the legal form. In its own words, law that would fail to articulate the experienced differences between fact situations or between the interests and values that appear relevant in particular problem areas, would seem altogether unacceptable, utopian and authoritarian simultaneously. Now, to my mind, it's evident from the conclusions of the ILC that it adopted a conceptual structure for the international legal system that I think permeates its other reports. And I think, although Fernando is probably better placed than I am to speak on this, but my exposure and engagement with ILC reports is that they do proceed from a common unity of purpose. They privilege systemic unity, they privilege the resolution of internal conflicts between legal principles. Coherence is a formal and abstract value for it that's connected to the stated aims of predictability and legal security. For the ILC, what is interesting, and I'm not sure that it's interesting for everyone, but is to focus on the wealth of techniques in the traditional law for dealing with tension and conflict between existing legal principles and which seek to establish meaningful relationships between them. So if systematicity is understood thus, I have objections to it. I think then it becomes a concept that serves to privilege the surface coherence and the harmonization of international law rather than reflecting on the purposes for which it was designed and whether it's actually achieving those purposes. And in that respect, this takes me to the second point that I'm trying to build, which is the role of sources theory and how thinking about sources enjoys pride of place in that conception of systematicity, both in constructing and maintaining that system, but equally, and this I'll deal with in the third part of my presentation, in providing the techniques and the vocabulary and tools through which an actor can intervene to ensure the system's coherence or to act instrumentally in the service of a political, strategic, or ideological objective. So the claim that I'd like to build on now is the co-constitutive relationship between thinking systematically, or thinking about international law systematicity, and the place of sources within that. And in its modern form in the English-speaking world, again, the one that we're most comfortable with, I believe that such thinking about legal systems derives from the classic union of primary and secondary rules in Hart's concept of law. Now, if this starts sounding like a jurisprudence one lecture, please stop me. But I think there is something to be said about that union of primary and secondary rules. So for those of you who haven't necessarily read it, I've just got a brief excursion into it, because I think there are compelling reasons to think about how sources of international law constitute that set of rules. Now, the first one is that this Hartian union of primary and secondary rules embeds the systematic character of the legal system within the existence and union of duty-imposing rules, so those are the primary rules, and the standards and procedures according to which they're ascertained, determined, terminated, interpreted, or validated. So, because all of these rules derive from Hart's famous rule of recognition, and the rule of recognition remains the only source for the rules in the legal system, then the legal system requires that rule in order to ascertain the existence of other rules. And you see how the circular relationship evolves. So what constitutes that circle? Where is there, I think, the gap in Hart's way of thinking? And I think there's an elision in respect of that rule of recognition because it is simultaneously the source of all other valid rules and a necessary condition for identifying the existence of the legal system. To my mind, it's the agents, but I'll get to that in a moment. The thing is that if if there is this circular relationship between sources and the system, then they are in this co-constitutive relationship. They require each other for their existence. Sources require the system for validation, and the system requires sources in order to exist. And Joseph Raz has argued this. You know, this is hardly revolutionary, but in every legal system, you must have that rule of recognition, though that rule of recognition need not encompass all the criteria of validity of that legal system. Samantha Besson has made the point that any conceptual analysis of sources as secondary rules, again, rests on that source of recognition, which is required both to assess the validity of all rules within the system and ascertain it. And redolent of Kelsen's Grundnorm, if there is, then that source of sources is not itself legal. So this brings us to the particular question of the place of sources within the international legal system, and in particular, I'll focus on the role of Article 38 as an authoritative enumeration of the sources of international law. Now, it must be recalled from the outset, and this is at least my view, Article 38 is not the source of authority of the sources of international law. Rather, it's an instruction to the ICJ as to which sources of law it may apply, what Jörg Kammerhofer calls its lex arbitri. It's been observed by Jean d'Apremont that international law scholarship has with great pains avoided sustained analysis as to the source of sources, instead preferring a rule-based approach to sources which eschews theoretical rumination on these foundational questions. Now, those of you who, so this week while preparing for this lecture and perhaps procrastinating, I read the EGIL talk debate between Thurlow and d'Apremont. And you might agree with Thurlow, you might agree with d'Apremont, but I think there is something to be said about whether this rule-based approach actually applies. Now, I'd just like to point out though, that questions remain about the authority or status of Article 38. And in order to juice up my book sales, I'll ask you, I've written on this, so you might want to have a look on that, but I'll try to distill the argument here. Now, surely, Article 38 does not derive its authority merely by virtue of widespread ratification. That reduces it to nothing more than the customary evolution of a treaty provision that was signed 100 years ago. But yet, as scholars, as practitioners, as legal advisors to states, as activists, generally speaking, the enumeration contained there is accepted as the appropriate but also complete general statement on the sources of international law. And I can point you to about 15 textbooks where the point is made in passing, it is merely asserted and you move on. And that is problematic in some respects if it's not analyzed critically, because what it serves to do is it elevates Article 38 uncritically as some sort of meta-constitutional rule about the rules of international law. And I believe that there is a claim to be made that mere acceptance and practice by states is insufficient for establishing its validity as the source of sources. And where I locate that missing quality, that something extra, is within the social practices that constitute the system itself. And this brings me now slowly to the idea of systemic agency. Now, I see that I've been speaking for 25 minutes and I've still got quite a bit to go. I'm tempted to jump ahead. But I think I'm going to try to compress this argument a little bit. Essentially, I think that if one adopts a social theory on sources, which grounds the validity of sources not merely in the system itself, but also in the practice of law applying and interpreting authorities, that something else can be found. Now, this view does not negate the role of states. After all, if we discard the anthropocentric view of the state, we remember that states' bureaucracies, and especially their foreign ministries, are manned by international lawyers. And what's relevant is the practice of those international lawyers and who they deem to be relevant, who they are engaging with. Are they engaging with judgments? Are they looking to military manuals? Are they looking to diplomatic practice? That itself is also part of the social practice that creates international law. To bring that back to sources, then law ascertainment criteria do evolve in line with social practice and accommodate the practice of authorities and of agents beyond the banner of Article 38 without necessarily doing violence to it. So the question is, whose social practice is relevant? Is it merely that we exist in a system with a set of communitarian constraints and where there exists an interpretative community of international lawyers? That might be the case. Now, by interpretive community, what I mean, I'm drawing on the language of Owen Fiss and Stanley Fish. This is stuff that's been written about extensively before. I think Michael Weibel has written about the epistemic community of international lawyers. But in essence, what we're discussing is how a community of international lawyers shares a language of communication, but also an internalized system of principles which defines and constrains the types of legal argumentation accepted as valid. And this is a normative move. This puts the law-applying authority, which Hart describes as a legal official and leaves completely open, at the forefront of any systematic thinking about international law. Essentially, the claim that I'm trying to make is that international law systematicity is derived from social practice, it's derived from that social engagement with sources, and that the interpretative practice of law interpreting and law applying officials become constitutive of the existence of the legal system itself. And on that, I will rely on Martti Koskinniemi. On this point, I do agree. As he says, every rule needs, for its application, an auctoritas interpositio that determines what the rule should mean for a particular case, and whether, all things considered, it is right to apply it or perhaps have recourse to the exception. Such a construction allows for the distillation of the mindset of the international legal professional through a critical understanding of the intervention of law-applying officials. And I think it also returns us to Hart's theory on systematicity as a theory of legal systems rooted in social fact. Now, Hart's concept of law does make room, it makes extensive room, for the existence of certain specific social practices. He terms those the practice of legal officials who act to safeguard the existence of that system. He calls that the internal point of view, the idea that these officials, through their engagement with law, are devoted to maintaining it, are devoted to safeguarding it for its own sake. Now, it's worth recalling, though, that Hart refers unsystematically to the practice of courts, to the practice of legislatures, of administrative officials, and even of private citizens. But I think a careful reading reveals that the only behavior which is necessary for the existence of the legal system is that of the officials. So as law-applying officials, as quintessentially embodied in the idea or notion of a judge, as Ronald Dworkin takes it, who are empowered specifically to decide on what is legal and to distinguish between the legal and the extra-legal. And that criterion of relevance, of distinction, is key. Now, I think there's a lot to be said on this. I think there's a lot to be said about my own argument in that respect, that the existence of the legal system rests not only on the existence of sources, but how they're used by designated legal officials. I accept that it is a normative move, and this is a critique that David Kennedy would have made, although he made it 20 years ago, not to my actual argument. But the way he's placed it, in order to fulfill the desire for an autonomous system of normative sources, argument about the sources of international law, like sources doctrine itself, include strands associated both with normative autonomy and normative authority. Sources argument is interesting, both because it pursues a rhetorical strategy of inclusion, and because it manages the relations between these two rhetorical strands as to solve the process of the problem of sources discourse as a whole. That intimate symbiotic relationship that I'm trying to sketch out, which links the sources of the system with those officials or agents entrusted with its application, to me indicates the social and institutional dimensions of international law, and it transcends merely its form. Essentially, to simplify the point, I'm making the argument that if there exists an international legal system, it is not just a set of rules, principles, and decisions. It is those rules, principles, and decisions unified by a doctrine of sources which is deployed strategically by a number of officials. And that that social component is a necessary part for any social system that we call international law. And I think the consequences of that claim are not merely in relation to systematicity, but also have implications in relation to international law's resilience and its capacity to endure change. As Professor Benvenisti has suggested, the systemic or constitutional conception of international law supplies relatively independent bureaucracies and judiciaries with doctrines. These doctrines enable them to expand their authority while maintaining coherence and consistency through broad interpretation of treaties and the development of customary international law. I don't see him here, but there you are, sorry, my eyesight is not fantastic. But you know, perhaps I'm misquoting you, but that the understanding that I've got is that you've got this recursive relationship between the systemic conception of international law and the sources it provides to officials to act upon. And in this regard, and this brings me to the point, to the thrust of my argument, the very act of designating organs or officials to take note of what the law is and to apply it constitutes an implicit or even explicit authorization of those institutions to develop international law beyond the mere intention of states. Distilled to its essence, and the avenue of research that I'm currently engaged on, the system has begun to acquire what Nicholas Luhmann, the sociologist, would term an autopoetic quality of self-reproduction. In fact, one could go as far as does Anthony D'Amato, who suggested that this quality of self-perpetuation is recursively linked and even necessary for the existence of the system itself. adding an additional purposive dimension of self-organization. So international law no longer exists merely for the protection of certain interests or the advancement of certain values, but also exists for its own sake, in order to perpetuate itself. And on that point, I think, the circle between official sources and the legal system itself is squared. And this is something on which I'd particularly welcome your remarks. So I've got a few minutes left, and I'd like to leave some room for discussion. But I'd like to conclude a little bit on who might these systemic agents be. Those that my sense and training as an international lawyer identify, in many respects, are as follows. Although I think just before I get to that point, and I realize, sorry, this is the final adjustments to my lecture, before identifying who I believe to be systemic agents, I think I'll set out a bit of a test for it. And that key component is itself, unfortunately and regrettably, rather circular. I classify someone as a systemic agent if they possess recognition from the audience of other systemic agents. Again, I accept that that's circular, but I think it's necessary when we're looking at a socially constructed system of like international law. And it's also in line with the empirical work that is being done, particularly by the ICORT Centre of Excellence. You've got Karen Alter, Lawrence Helfer, and Mikael Rax Madsen, who are also working on this idea of, they call it de facto authority, and who possesses it. And they're trying to identify through empirical work how international courts are making these claims of de facto, so not necessarily legitimate, but substantive or effective authority. And although these are wider notions that deserve further exploration, I think they go slightly beyond the focus of this lecture, because I do want to focus on the ideas of systematicity and agency. But suffice to say that systemic agents claim and assert a measure of de facto authority in order to engage with international law, and that claim in turn, is my view, is recognized by other systemic agents. So let's turn to the enumeration, and I think this will probably be where I'll wind down. Obviously, the most clearly and obviously empowered are those individuals who represent and act on behalf of states, and in particular their executives. National administrative agencies, which have recourse to international law to validate their own mandates and their own purposes, or actively have recourse to it in order to guide them in making a decision. They're the ones who formally hold most legal obligations and, in the name of the state, are in control of lawmaking processes. Again, though, let us lift the veil of the state as an anthropocentric legal person. And let's wonder also about the collection of individuals that take decisions on its behalf. And let's think about whom they accept and appeal to as using appropriate legal sources and argumentation. Who validates the practice of states and the decisions of states? Now, I think probably the most obvious, and I've been hinting at it throughout my lecture, are judicial institutions, specifically international ones, but also supranational courts and regional courts and even domestic courts, as well as the cognate arbitral bodies that employ similar argumentative methods, for example, in the areas of trade or investment law or international criminal law. They are closest analogically to Hart's conception of the legal official. Through the act of delegation that states have conferred on them, the mandate to interpret and apply the law, they command a heightened degree of authority, and they are designated and empowered to apply the rules of the system as it is. In some respects, I would call them systemic officials, a subset of systemic agents, because they are designated in a more or less formal way. Now, Alter, Helfer, and Rax Madsen are spearheading empirical work on how various different bodies, not limited to the ECHR, the European Court of Human Rights, or the ECJ, but equally regional courts from around the world, the World Trade Organization, and the International Criminal Court, and how the bodies construct and claim de facto authority using legal argumentation and the sources of international law in order to feed back into that system. I won't go into that more. I'll direct you to the really interesting work. But I will make the claim that they are very relevant because what they're pointing to and highlighting is the use of a shared argumentative method that appeals beyond the core audiences of states and also perhaps beyond the international courts, national courts, and regional courts and litigants. Now, who else might be a systemic agent and would not be a systemic official? Less obvious are the many international advisory bodies and standard-setting bodies that exist across various specialized regimes. The UN Human Rights Committee is an obvious one, or the International Law Commission, which in practice, although they're relegated in Article 38 as only being subsidiary means for the determination of law, command substantive normative influence. Though through their work and in discharging their functions and through their adherence and use of legal sources in the way that is accepted by the epistemic community, they make a silent claim to authority. And in that silent claim, I believe they embody a claim to systemic agency, whether they're participating in the guardianship of systemic coherence, and notwithstanding any content-independent authority they command. Beyond that, I mean, we start moving into different categories where the work in designating them and justifying them perhaps needs to be done, but employees of international organizations and other international courts also acquire an element of systemic agency. And something I've written on in the past, and I think is of direct relevance for everyone in this room, is the role of academics and legal practitioners, and the way that we master and the series of techniques and vocabularies that allow us to be accepted as an international lawyer. I mean, here at the Lauterbach Center, I think I'm speaking at one of the elite institutions, and I think there is a particular awareness, I should hope, of that particular resonance that one has when one claims to be at the Lauterbach Center and part of the Cambridge tradition of international law, deploying legal sources in a specific manner. There is a claim to authority being made as such. And I mean, look, I'm hardly one to speak. I've been educated in the lead institutions. I've worked for the ICJ. I have used those strategically to make my point. And I think the very act of using that, the very act of internalizing a certain method and mode of reasoning itself also constitutes a claim to authority and a claim to systemic agency that we've got to be aware of. Because what we're doing is, through our academic work, through our practice work, we're seeking eventually to influence the perception of international law by states or by judicial institutions. We're seeking perhaps to influence the outcome of judgments, certainly if we're acting as counsel before these courts. We're seeking to influence policy when we work with international institutions, when we work with civil society. We're acting with law instrumentally, perhaps to pursue our own career objectives, but also in line with strategic and political objectives and even ideological motives. Above all, my point is that systemic agents are characterized by the use of these strategies to appeal to different constituencies and audiences in order to be accepted as part of the community of international lawyers. Now, I'm running out of time, so I'm going to give one small example of that interoperability of system, sources, and agents. And I'm going to use the recognition of customary international law to make the point. Now, there are two specific mechanisms worth identifying in the determination of custom. One of them is that as a matter of our social practice, generally speaking, great weight is given to when an international court or tribunal is willing to declare that something is crystallizing the customary law. That imprimatur, especially by the ICJ, is often regarded as validating. It's often regarded by international lawyers and by states as actually creating the norm. Even though we don't accept that it is formally creative, I think we accept that it is substantively creative of this unwritten norm of law. And I think that that important validating rule vests them not only with considerable authority, but it also vests them with considerable discretion to do so. And with the ICJ, I take particular issue with it, because this is the case. Despite the court's rather taciturn treatment of customary law, when the court is given an avalanche of state practice and given abundant legal materials on which to rest its claim, very often it simply declares a rule to be valid custom. I mean, a really obvious example is the obligation to prosecute and extradite, where the court looks at whether Belgium had standing under the Articles on State Responsibility, and essentially it says, it is custom that a state may assert a claim erga omnes partes, that is it, we don't need to go any further than that, and off we go. And I think that sort of practice is itself a declaration of authority. It is custom because we say so, and we do not need to justify this any further, is what we would call the quintessential assertion of content-independent authority. So essentially, what the ICJ is doing when it acts in this way is it's saying, I tell you what the law is, I do not tell you why the law is this, and I expect you to obey because of who I am. If I stand up and say Article 48 of the ILC Articles is custom, no one's going to listen to me. But if I give reasons, then that would be what we would call content-dependent authority. The ICJ doesn't have to have recourse to that, and I think that's a phenomenon that is a little bit understudied and something that we need to be thinking about how judicial institutions make assertions strategically to reinforce their content-independent authority. And more, although I don't engage specifically with the ICC, my colleagues who are ICC specialists say that more and more you're starting to see that in that particular court as well. A second illustration, I think, of this recursive relationship, and I think I'll stop after this one, can be framed through Anthea Roberts's reflective interpretative concept of custom, which demonstrates the mutually productive relationship between those who claim the authority to apply the law and the construction of the system. Now, Roberts posits that judicial institutions can deploy a dimension of fit in their reasoning process when determining whether a valid rule exists and is binding. Through this criterion, I think what she's doing is in effect bringing in a Dworkinian or possibly Rawlsian notion that reconciles plausible interpretations of custom, but it is ultimately based, and this is perhaps where it becomes contestable, on the purposive approach of international law. It essentially, by asserting that courts may have recourse to a dimension of fit when determining custom, what she's doing is she's allowing them the discretion to devise guidelines to reconcile practice and principles over time, and at specific points of the institution's choosing to intervene and to make and to fit this emerging customary norm in its vision of what international law is. As she claims, the best interpretation of custom is the one that makes practice appear in the best light, judged according to the substantive aspirations of the legal system. And those of the more critical sensibility would understand why I'm emphasizing the problematic nature of substantive aspirations. I think if Roberts' interactional theory holds, then the relationship between legal sources, an official's claim to systemic agency or authority, and the systemic qualities of international law has never been clearer. It also raises the question of the standard against which the assessment of custom is fitted. Roberts has little to say on this. She invokes a dimension of substance to suggest that a coherent explanation can draw from extra-legal sources such as lex ferenda to ethics and morality to resolve a choice between two plausible explanations. And although she raises a distinction between purely facilitative rules, which facilitate coexistence and cooperation, and those in the middle of the spectrum, which involve these moral considerations, she specifically attributes this to human rights and environmental law. Again, these examples, to my mind, don't settle the question. Who decided that these are systemic values which serve to define and constitute international law? Or even wider values that extend beyond the system itself? That word, the notion of values, might be grounded in the view of law as normative order. I mean, these could be values associated to the rule of law, such as clarity, publicity, certainty, or equality. But the evergreen question arises again. Is there a moral or value-laden basis through which judicial institutions and other systemic agents ought to be interpreting and applying international law? To my mind, that debate over values is highly contested, both from the mainstream positivist and more critical positions, and through a fuller treatment of these, although a fuller treatment is perhaps beyond the scope of this particular lecture, because I do say I've spoken for 45 minutes, sorry, it should suffice to point out that the conferral of discretion on such systemic agents, especially on judicial institutions, itself privileges a choice of values. So to conclude, and forgive me for the rather circular and detailed presentation, I do believe that at the very least, ruminating on the socially constructed foundations of international law allows us to escape trying to fit international law into a domestic law paradigm, into a domestic law concept. I don't think that thinking about international law as a legal system accepts that the law of some domain, you know, claims or enjoys supremacy over normative orders. That's not necessarily what I'm trying to do here. I'm trying just to move beyond the modernist ideal of law as an autonomous, self-standing system and emphasize the social practices, the elite practices that constitute international law, and the role that all of us play within that. Now, I hope to achieve here, and I welcome questions in this regard, but I do hope that it will allow international lawyers, us, to reflect on and perhaps challenge our basic assumptions as to the nature and function of the international legal system and the social dynamics that generate it. Perhaps in doing so, we can reconcile our position as professional actors whose political agendas colour and contribute actively to the formation of the law, and take seriously the exhortation that a more reflective, politically aware stance in our engagement with the substance of international law is not only desirable but perhaps necessary. Thank you.